Welcome to World Cafe Words and Music from WXBN. I'm David Dye. Robin Hitchcock joins us today on the cafe. He has an inventive new album called The Man Upstairs, which is a combination of covers and originals. The idea came from producer Joe Boyd, known for his work with early Pink Floyd, Nick Drake, Fairport Convention, and others, who suggested the format. Hitchcock's long career began with the Soft Boys, his psychedelic band with Kimberly Rue back in the 1970s. Rue went on to write Walking on Sunshine, the international feel-good song. I talked with Robin earlier in the year, and I commented on his penchant for making records that go well with the fall season.
It's my favorite time of year. I mean, visually, it's the best time of year. It's the best time of year to be here in the northeast of the States. You know, the pumpkins are out and the foliage is in all the different hues and shades. And in Britain, it's the same. It's the time of the year when the earth, the northern hemisphere, the temperate zones are at their most beautiful. It's the harvest time. You know, it's fulfillment and it's also melancholy and decay. And so, you know, this is, I'm a wasp to that apple, let's say. So it's a place I've been before many times. This is just my latest take on it.
You recorded this with Joe Boyd, who you'd had a really unusual tour with, and that he has a book out, and you were kind of the musical accompaniment to the book, right? I mean, he would tell
tales.
That's right. He would tell tales, and you would provide the songs.
I bookended the chapters with songs from the characters that he mentioned, you know, Bob Dylan going electric at Newport, or him meeting the Incredible String Band, or Nick Drake, or working on the first Pink Floyd single. So, you know, we usually had about five chapters. There's about seven songs, I guess.
You know, what an amazing, you juxtapose his career in with the things you love, and they kind of seem to fit perfectly.
Well, I grew up listening to that stuff. You know, I mean, Joe is a mere 11 years older than me, but back when I was 14, this would have made an enormous amount of difference. Joe would have done all these adult things that I wasn't yet capable of. You know, he was the other side of the glass, and it was a very exciting time to be either side of the glass, really, then, because they were the great momentum years of our 20th century culture, or certainly in our lifetimes.
Amen. And he produced this with an idea in mind that those of us, I've heard it expressed that he wanted to make a Judy Collins album, and those of us who grew up with those records kind of know exactly what he's talking about. Did you understand what that reference was?
Well, I did, although I hadn't actually heard those records, and he'd never worked with Judy Collins as far as I knew. So he wasn't referring back to the records of his that I heard in, you know, by people who wrote all their own material, like Nick Drake and the Incredible String Band. I mean, Fairport did a lot of covers, but he just said, well, yeah, I'll make a record with you, but I don't want to do a singer-songwriter record. I'm not interested in the... No offense, he said, driving his car along the English country road that we were driving along, he said, but I don't want to just have someone's latest collection of songs, even yours. And I thought, well, fine. But he said that about 2 years before we actually did it. He was just describing the conditions under which he would work. One is that he would want to do it in a week, which suits me fine because I'm impatient. And also, you know, it's not cheap making records if you're in a nice studio. So that was one of his big innovations was that, like, you know, match your originals with covers, which I thought was good because it also put me as a performer for the first time. You know, I grew up listening to all those singer-songwriter records, and so I always thought of myself as a singer-songwriter, that golden Elysian Valley where people like Roy Harper and Richard Thompson and Kevin Ayers and John Cale and, you know, my old hero Syd Barrett, all these people could make a living making a record that sold a few thousand copies, came out on a major label, and go around playing the colleges. You know, you weren't going to trouble the charts, and that's how I saw myself. obviously that the landscape's changed a bit since then, but that's been my principle. Joe cast me as a performer, as a recording artist, really for the first time in my career. He also brought in Jerry Boys, another Jay. Jerry had worked with Joe on some of his stuff in the early 70s, and I know Jerry also recorded Steel Eye Span, of whom I was a huge fan. So it's one of the best sounding records I've made.
It goes back to that idea of capturing a performance, which is...
Well, that's my belief, is that if you can perform 14 songs in an hour on stage, you should be able to do it in a recording studio. You know, you don't keep stopping on stage and going, huh, I don't know, should we try that one again? You know, you as a performer, you're front-loaded to do your best performances the first take. And I am not someone who improves with multiple takes. If I play a guitar solo, it gets worse the more I play it, you know? Like I said, I'm not patient. I'm not a studio craft dude. And I've been in situations where my records have been painstakingly made. And I don't think they're that satisfying. And I don't think people who like my stuff particularly go for them either. The things they tend to like, there are exceptions, tend to be the more spontaneous pieces. This is because, you know, I'm a child of Dylan. I started doing this like hundreds of thousands of little tadpoles by listening to Dylan. Only a few of us made it into Frogs, you know, with our Ray-Bans and our polka dot shirts, but nonetheless.
Well, I'm going to talk about shirts later, but you talked about this not being a singer-songwriter album, and yet there's some really nice new songs of yours. Do you want to start with one of yours?
Thank you. Yeah, this is on the record. I'm going to see if I can hit the notes. So this is Trouble in Your Blood. You got a heart full of soul and a mind beyond control, and the way you look down can't be
satisfy. God knows how much you just try. You got trouble in your blood, and your rose is full of mud. You can't be satisfied. Don't know what you do to me no more. Trouble in your blood goes on. Trouble in your blood goes on. Trouble in your blood goes on. On. Trouble in your blood goes on.
Robin Hitchcock, true to his word, in that a great first take of Trouble in Your Blood, which is from the new album, Thank The you. Man Upstairs. So yeah, I love this record for a number of reasons, including the fact that it's blissfully the correct length. It's 10 songs, a little over half hour.
That's 38 minutes, yeah.
I think that's important because you a lot of albums overstay their welcome.
Oh, you're not kidding. Well, you know, I think this is the part of the decline of the CD and part of the whole business of selling, the decline of selling recorded music. You know, LPs... The best length is about 40 minutes. Four of my favorite records are 38 minutes long, being Revolver by the Beatles, Document by REM, Avalon by Roxy Music, and Underwater Moonlight by the Soft Boys, my old band.
Yes.
And I don't think any of this was deliberate on the part of any of the people involved, but... It means you've got side, you know, you're about 19 minutes aside or whatever. You've got to, you know, it's about long enough. You can listen to a side and you can then flip it over, or you can listen to a side of another record, which is how I grew up listening to music. It's really hard to feel that way if someone presents you with 74 minutes of music, which is what wound up with compact discs. People, you know, that. People decided they didn't know what to chuck out, so they just keep it all in. Bands couldn't agree what to lose, you know. It sprawled. And I think people just began to not care. So, you know, I trim it. This record actually was 43 minutes long. We had another song, and right at the last minute, we took it out just because it just made it flow better. I mean, it wasn't a bad song. Somebody who'd heard the first version of the album said it was their favorite song. But, you know, good outtakes are always good outtakes.
I was going to ask about that because there are only five of your originals on here. And surely you must have had a whole bunch more that you at least demoed or played for Joe and that didn't make it or even record it. Do those songs, do they get lost or what happens?
Generally speaking, a lot of my old stuff tends to come out. I mean, I've put out quite a few collections over the years, or when the boxed sets come, you know, there's always the call to find demos. It's really hard for the artist to be the listener. That, you know, some artists have that ability to detach themselves from their work enough to imagine what it's like to hear it. But most of us don't, which is why you need a producer. Yeah. But that's the other problem with long-term projects, which, obviously, you know, there's less money around now to do that kind of thing. But in the days when you had record deals and you might spend 3 months in the studio or something, you'd have absolutely no perspective by by the end. Whenever I was involved with records like that, the vocals were mixed too low because we'd all got so used to the voice, we could hear it when it wasn't up there, you know.
You knew the lyrics, you didn't have to hear them.
Well, exactly. I know the lyrics, so yeah. you know. I mean, so yeah, I don't know. It's a fun thing to rant about, you know.
Right. Well, which direction do you want to go? You want to do another one of yours?
This is me trying to sing this one. This is going to be recalling the truth, I hope. If I don't make the notes, then we'll have to try something else. But
recalling the truth, the way that it seems, the way that it falls between you and your dreams, the way you said yes as you followed me in. Been gone so long, recalling the truth. Now, what could that be? The truth can just change like the tide on the sea, when the river runs out and the mountain grows dim, you've been gone so long. Kiss on the stairs, a heartbeat embrace, a kiss in the morning on the side of your face. Just once for the price of a kiss, if the price is too high, then to pay it's a sin. You've been gone long. You hide from yourself, but it's tracking you down. It was me that was lost, and it's you that I've found. Doesn't last long, whatever does, do the men always end where the women begin? You've so long. You've been gone so long. You've been gone
That is Recalling the Truth, the song that finishes up The Man Upstairs. As Robin Hitchcock is our guest today. I want to talk a little bit about the Soft Boys, because when the Soft Boys started, it was kind of at this point where punk began at the same time. And I've seen people try to deal with this by calling them proto-punk, and I'm not sure what that means. But it seems to me that you all related far more to the music that came before than you did to punk, except in terms of energy. How do you see it?
Oh, completely. But I think what you have to remember is that everybody in that period knew what came before. They were just an orthodoxy developed quite fast, where you were supposed to come up with something new. You weren't supposed to fall back on harmonies or guitar solos or middle eights or anything that Paul McCartney might do or David Gilmour. You know, it was an attempt to kind of, it was like growing a plant that didn't have any roots. So it kind of got everywhere very fast, but I don't know how much it went down deep. I mean, people are very emotionally attached to punk, particularly in Britain, because it was their youth, just as I was attached to psychedelia because it was mine. But, you know, at the time, most people who were making records, they knew all about the Beatles and the Stones and Pink Floyd and all that. They just chose to try and bypass it. So people like XTC and Elvis Costello and Squeeze was kind of authentic new wave acts in the eyes of the press and the fans, and they cut their hair and they played short, sort of kind of aggressive sounding songs. But actually, they were all Beatle kids, and I've met them all later, and you know, they're all chock full of Beatle chords. We just didn't bother to disguise ourselves. We didn't cut our hair. We stuck with the harmonies. We were trying to produce relatively sophisticated music. I mean, some of the guys in the band were into Steely Dan and the Beach Boys, which was too sophisticated for me, too airtight. We all liked harmony. And we arrived at a very bad time. You know, we arrived on the wrong planet at the wrong time. And you know, we hatched out and died. We didn't last very long, but we left enough sort of seeds around for a start for all of us to have our own subsequent careers. You know, I think what we were part of was linking the 60s to the 80s, if you like. Because we were so obviously, so apparently retro, we weren't intentionally retro. We just didn't, our tastes weren't affected by the fashion. We didn't feel, you know, we did speed up a bit because of punk and new wave and stuff, but we didn't feel that the great things in 60s music needed to be discarded. But, you know, we weren't pretending that it was, we weren't, you know, flower children or anything like that. You know, the mood had changed completely from, you know, it was dystopia by 77, and I totally shared the dystopia with the punks and things, but I just didn't musically go this, you know, none of us in the Soft Boys, we weren't into the same kind of sonic dystopia, if you like. So we in a way we created a sort of music in a parallel world, the way things might have gone. And just to bring it back, I think in terms of definition, I think we were, the Soft Boys, in retrospect, were art rock. And mm-hmm. I don't think you can ever play art rock in your time. The two other famous art rock bands are the Velvet Underground and Roxy Music, but I don't recall anyone describing them as that back then, you know.
Absolutely not. That's interesting. And the other thing I wanted to ask is, you have a certain sartorial flair that you wear a series of shirts that I kind of imagine Brian Jones could have worn or Dylan once he'd been to England, yeah, and come back.
Yeah.
Where do you find them? Are you talking about retro, or are these shirts being made today, or do you go back? For instance, today you're wearing a lovely black and white polka dot shirt.
Thank you. This is by Charlie Allen of Islington. You have to kind of find them. They're sort of. But either you go to a bespoke tailor and have them made up. But a lot depends on the schmatter, whether you can find the right kind of patterns. Sometimes they're not there. Nobody can find any polka dots, and then suddenly polka dots will sweep through for a couple of years, and then there'll be a polka dot drought. So you've got to sort of keep your eye open for the material and also find tailors who are happy to make stuff for you. And it's also not cheap, but I think shirts are a good investment as far as I'm concerned. I like them.
Is your roller bag like filled with a shirt per show, or do you repeat?
No, I have to repeat because I change my shirt for the encores. So I probably travel around with about 6 shirts. I try not to wear the same shirt in the same town. I used to keep a shirt and set list journal, but I've got slack about it. Uh-huh. So I wouldn't come back to Philly and wear the same shirt and play exactly the same set that I played 3 years previously. But,
Well, for this final song, Robin Hitchcock is not changing his shirt, but what would you like to finish up with?
I'm going to try and do the Crystal Ship, which is track 4, side 2, the old Doors song, but... to have another kiss, another flashing chance at bliss, another kiss, another kiss. The days are bright and filled with pain, and close me in your gentle rain. The time we ran was too insane. We'll meet again, we'll meet again. Streets of fields that never die. Deliver me from reasons why you'd rather cry. I'd rather fly. The crystal ship is being filled, a thousand girls, a thousand thrills, a million ways to spend your time. When we get back, I'll drop a line.
The Doors song, the Crystal Ship, which is one of the covers on The Man Upstairs, Robin Hitchcock's new album. A delight, as always. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
I'm David Dye. World Cafe Words and Music from WXPN is produced at WXPN in Philadelphia. If you'd like to hear more of our World Cafe sessions and get daily cafe alerts, you can sign up at our website at worldcafe.npr.org. As always, Thanks for spending your time with the World Cafe.